Welcome back to another episode of MRP, Minority Report Podcast. This is Karell Cooper. I'm flying solo today. Eric can't join us today. He will be back for the next episode. We miss him as always, and looking forward to him joining us for the next one. But with that said, I've got a very exciting guest joining us today. Very excited about this conversation with Kiemfer Flannery Rye, founder, principal, DEI, and culture practitioner. Kiemfer, how are you doing?
I'm good, Karell. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us today. How's your Q1 going for you so far?
You know, it's been pretty interesting because I think since the last time we spoke, I bought a new business on top of what I currently do.
Wow. Okay.
So it's been a kind of a hectic Q1, I have to say. Yeah. So I acquired a new company in addition to what I do, right? I own a company called Inclusion Equals. However, I just purchased as of January 1st an organization called the F-Bomb Breakfast Club.
Wow. Wow. Congratulations. Thank you. We will get into a little bit about that shortly, but let's start by giving our listeners a little background on yourself. Tell us, where were you born? Where were you raised?
Yeah. So I have a really interesting story. I mean, not to say many people don't have an interesting story, but I was actually born in South Korea. I was born there in a small farm community. To be honest, I'm not even sure where, but took a little bit of a sad, I would say, curve and ended up at an orphanage for at least a couple of years. But I had the really profound shift in my world by being adopted to a small rural farm community in Iowa. So what was interesting about that is, like, for those of you, many of you hopefully have never experienced dealing with homelessness or dealing with abandonment. Getting a little heavy here, Karell. But, you know, so I dealt with a lot of things, especially being in an orphanage, right? So I'm thinking, yeah, I'm saved. I'm in the U.S. I'm, you know, doing all of that. Unfortunately, that was in the early 80s. And for anyone in your listening group that have been around a bit, early 80s, we ended up with the farm crisis. And so I was adopted into a small farm community. That meant farm aid, farm crisis, all the things that happened. So another round of loss. So, yeah, so that was sort of my initial early experiences in my life, going through multiple, I would say, insecurities, right? Food insecurities, you name it, experienced it. But I love the fact that being here, when I say here, I'm in the US, I did have more opportunities than I could have been an orphan in South Korea. And so now here I am, been to college. I had my Bachelor of Fine Arts. My practice was in painting mostly. Also have my MBA in business, been an executive. So my life has really changed a lot. And it's because of all the people that have surrounded me, because, you know, we never do it alone.
Yeah, that is true. We never do it alone. And that's kind of what I wanted to ask you about, going back to your early years. I mean, that had to have been a very traumatic experience, you know, for you or any child, you know, experiencing some of the things that you went through. What kept you going? What got you through that? Were there, again, people, influences in your life? Did you have a support structure around you? Just trying to sort of understand a little bit more, Kim, how did you navigate those early years and what kept you going?
Yeah, I think, you know, what's interesting is that as an adult now, I can look back and go, oh, we learn a lot of superpowers, trauma-based superpowers, right? So one of the things, like, I learned to read the room really early on, very quickly. Part of it has to do with, like, if you don't want to put yourself in those kind of scenarios, you just have to do that. I think that I've always had a positive outlook. I think that is maybe just innately me. You know, there's that whole, like, nurture nature thing. And I think there is something to be said about natural part of my, maybe like just my DNA. I've always been an optimist. I think just having that kind of mindset has helped me at a personal level. And as I went through all of these scenarios, especially in the younger years, there was always a bit of a spotlight. There's always someone that have made a difference along the way, even back in the orphanage. But definitely when I came to the U.S., even though our family went through the farm crisis, initially, my mom, my adopted mom, also, you know, for me, I just call her my mom. She had such a big heart. My whole family is adopted. So I'm adopted. My sister is adopted. She's also Korean. She's Korean American, biracial. She was adopted. I have a blonde hair, blue eyed brother who recently passed, unfortunately, was adopted. I have a dark hair, dark eye brother who was also adopted. She was just really overflowing of love for family. And she just couldn't have her own children. And so that was her way of just creating the family for herself and also fostered three brothers as well. So, you know, that had a huge impact, knowing, I think also as an adoptee, that someone loved me enough, wanted me enough to go through the process to bring me there. And then as we went through the farm crisis, my mother, who hadn't worked for years. She was in her 50s by then. I'm the youngest and I'm in my 50 right now. So, you know, she hadn't worked for a long time because farming was really quite wealthy in the earlier years, but she was a nurse. She went back to work to take care of us, you know, had to get back on the food lines, things like that. And just knowing that there are people out there will do whatever they can to make you successful and make you better. I mean, that means a lot. I also had a really great friend when I was younger where their family kind of absorbed me in during those hard times. So got to spend a lot of time there, make sure I was fed well and had additional opportunities. I had a wonderful art teacher, Ms. Squires, who still is such an impact to me, who really saw my artistry as something that was really important to me. And I think my artistry or being an artist really saved me in a lot of ways, right? There's that. And then to oddly, like boyfriends and girlfriends and people that were around that just helped me along to found family that you surround yourself with. And it could be like, because I need to borrow $50 to put gas in the car and get some groceries, right? Earlier on, yes. To being able to now like give back continuously. And so they're just so many people and some people that don't even know that they've impacted me.
Right.
I try to share that they've impacted me, but not in this profound way. I don't think they can truly understand, right? And talking about even mentors along the way, every time I have a friend now, I used to say, you know, she's my mentor. And Anika would always be like, oh, no, we're peers. I'm like, yeah, but you also had a major impact, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, so, definitely.
Yeah. So again, we just don't do it alone, even if you feel lonely. I think that's the really interesting thing. It's also being a solopreneur in a lot of ways, although, or entrepreneur, I have a team, but you know, you can feel quite lonely in that scenario, but you are also surrounded by your community. So yeah.
That is true. And how do you think the experience that you had growing up shaped who you are today? And does it also influence the work that you do on a day-to-day basis as well?
Yeah, absolutely. For me, my lived experience has a tremendous amount as to why I do what I do. I think you hear that probably from a lot of DEI practitioners, actually, right? Their lived experiences is what really drives them. I had a moment in my life where I went through a really massive transition. I was part of an executive team. I was a vice president and executive creative director for a digital marketing agency here in Seattle that eventually got acquired by Accenture. And I was getting my executive MBA. And that during that time, I went to a Jesuit school, university, and they have a really strong teaching about what does it mean to be a servant leader? What does it mean to be an ethical leader in the global commons that you share with others? What does it mean to have deeply embedded social justice, right, into your leadership? And also understanding that the decisions you make can have as a leader massive economical, you know, like impact at a macro and micro level. And so during that time, I really went through a transformation. And that's when I made the change because I always had that inkling inside, right? But that time is when I was able to really shift and understand my three areas of very specific areas of service, because I was a bit of a bleeding heart. And I think that's part of, you know, the way that I grew up is that I'm like, oh yeah, that organization, this organization, yes, I'm at a place where I can give back financially with my time, whatever. So I was just like doing it like that and then realized that, okay, there are three areas that are very specifically hierarchical way, like more important to me than some of the other areas. And, you know, it's youth experiencing barriers. Well, hello, I will say youth experiencing barriers, you know, part of the LGBTQIA community. Oh, well, hello, I'm part of the LGBTQIA community. Oftentimes, like the bi erasure is real, but I am part of the community. And then the third is in the arts. And so for me, being able to get that specific about my service needs and then wrap around what does my servant leadership might look like in my business world really helped me to get honed in. And so giving back is super important to me. It is a deep, deep value of mine because, again, it's hard to get through the world on your own. And for me, I had that opportunity given to me and also my hard work as well, obviously. But for me, it's like there are others out there that need that support in many ways. So that's part of the reason why I have a really big philanthropy heart as well in the things that I do. I mentor as many women as possible. I work on nonprofit board that supports youth and arts and youth, especially facing barriers, because I know how important art was for me when I was going through all of that. But also knowing that someone who looks like me, and for those of you, I'm an Asian woman, Korea, from South Korea, and the idea of being othered, right? Being othered is a real thing because there weren't a whole lot of people that looked like me where I grew up,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. And this idea that Asians in general are considered foreigners in their own land, right? I don't know how often I've been asked, like, where are you from? You know, like that thing, even though I am an American citizen now. And I did happen to come from South Korea, but that is not the case for a lot of Asians that live here. And just that knowing and growing up in that otherness was really important for me to figure out and how I can be of service to work in this DEI space for people to feel belonged.
I want to ask you a little bit more about the DEI space, because in many ways, DEI is under attack right now.
Yeah.
Right. And one of the things that is listed in your bio on LinkedIn is you say you believe company's culture is the heart and soul of the organization. But with DEI under the attack that it is under right now, what is your approach to sort of making sure that organizations, if you will, have DEI sort of embedded in their company culture, right? Because it has to be, you know, embedded in the company culture if it's going to really be a part of the heart and soul of the organization. I think you get what I'm trying to say here.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. For sure. Well, here's the thing is that those that don't want it, you can't tell them to want it. Right. That's becoming more and more apparent now, right?
But they also shouldn't tell those of us who do want it that we can't have it.
Either. Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. Right. So right now in the current political state of DEI, which shouldn't be politicized, but it has turned into a political issue. And what's been fascinating for me to watch, because human nature and brain science behind it is just an area that I do study and is just, again, very fascinating for me, is that the way that DEI went across the nation, across the world, as we know, was because of the line in the sand that was drawn after George Floyd's murder. I mean, we know this. This happened. And then all the promises came, all the statements came, all of the whatever, right? And so then at that time, not only individuals, but because of individuals pushing and also at the society level at that time, you got a lot of business peer pressure, to sign up, to do, and do a lot of performativeness, to be honest, right? But for businesses that really were committed, they're like, oh, wow, like we've been talking about it or thinking about it. We just didn't know how to do it. We now really need to do it, right? So they were going in. And then we had a lot of followers that were very much looking at it from a gain, you know, and I'm using that air quotes gain. And what's happening now that like the pendulum has swung so far, anytime pendulum in society swings one way, it's going to swing back the other way. So what's happening now is that the organizations that were truly trying to make the change happen are staying true to it. Like they're raising their hand saying, I don't care if we're, you know, like our assets are being like pulled down or whatever it is, we think this is the right thing to do and it's the important thing to do and it has business impact and our people impact. What we're seeing now is that the people that were doing it in a performative way or organizations that were doing it in a performative way are using this moment as an excuse to pull back.
Right.
So we're seeing more and more of that. And I get this question often is like, but shouldn't you be helping those people? Like people who already know, you know, like find it important. They already have that. Isn't it? Shouldn't you be doing the hard work?
Those people don't want the help though.
Yes. I'm like, why am I going to butt against the wall? That's not going to make any impact. Not only waste my time and energy on those folks, when I could use my time and energy over here with people that saying like, help us, we just don't know how to do it, right? Yeah. So that has way more impact on the people that want it and the organizations that want it, because then they will have a reverberation effect around their community, right? Versus some parts are unmovable forces.
Right. Do you still have faith that DEI, this movement that really started a couple of years ago, will continue to drive change, not only within organizations that want change, but in society as a whole?
I do. I really do. Part of it could be my optimistic perspective. I think I told you I'm a bit of an optimist, but also we've seen this over and over in society. I oftentimes look at sustainability. Like think about in the way that sustainability has moved into organization. There's a lot of greenwashing that was happening for a long time, and there still is, but ultimately it's required across now, right? It's become a standard structural systems practice. I think DEI will get there as well.
Gotcha. Okay. I want to switch topics a little bit, going back to the opener. Tell us about the F-Bomb Breakfast Club.
So F-Bomb Breakfast Club was originally founded by a woman named Megan McNally, one of also my mentors. She founded this company. This is in its eighth year. She led it for 7 years. She created it because she realized that, again, as women business owners, wanted a place where they can have peer groups to support each other to bring their businesses up. And it was a place to be safe, you know, swear like sailors and build badass businesses. And so they called it getting up at the ass crack of dawn here in Seattle at 7 a.m., no matter what, every first Friday meetings. I was a member for 6 out of the 7 years, or maybe 5.5 years of it. And just the energy of 100 women or more showing up in, you know, it's dark out here on the wintertime. Like literally it's dark out at 7 a.m. and still getting together to support each other and make their businesses better. And when she was ready to transition and think about moving into the next phase, which she's working on, what's called the F-Bomb Angels, which we are a angel funding group for women. She was looking for someone who might take the lead and raised my hand and said, inclusion equals, might like to acquire that. And because I think it aligns with our mission. So it's been a really exciting ride. I'm only a few months into it. And we're in the moment of looking to see and looking to the community to see what the next evolution will look like. So trying to co-create and co-design with each other. And it's a place for women, thems and gentle thems, who are founders, who are entrepreneurs and business owners, to come join. And we really do. We just get busy and work on the hard things that makes us business owners.
Love it. Love it. Well, congrats again. And
thank you.
Follow up question to that. When you are looking at a potential acquisition target or a target to invest in, what are some of the characteristics in the business or the company culture that you look for that really catches your eye that, you know, says, okay, I'm going to make this decision to move forward here?
Yeah, I would say because this is my first company that I actually purchased. So, you know, and so rest, I've started on my own. And so I would say this probably goes for across the board, who I work with, right, as clients, along with, you know, the company that I purchased. And then as an angel investor who I invest in, there's a value alignment that has to happen, right? So value alignment for one, deep understanding of the importance, not necessarily that you understand DEI thoroughly, but the importance of DEI.
Importance, okay.
Number one, right? That spaces needs to be inclusive and create places of belonging, right? You can change the business looking at systems and really integrating DEI into the systems. And so that goes in all the ways that I look at. And when it comes to specifically in the investment side, I look at businesses that are going to have some kind of social impact. Right? That's a really important thing for me. We're trying to do some kind of change where it will impact the society in some way. And I was invited to speak at a University of Washington at a class. It's a class on funding, like VC, financial funding class. And I had told them, I said, honestly, like if someone said, hey, Kimper, you want to invest in another tender or something like that? I'd be like, no, it doesn't align for me. Like, I think people who use it and who meet their match that way or for, you know, social outings or whatever you want to do, that's fine. But from a society level, what is it really adding? Right? Yeah. Like, they're gamifying people, dehumanizing people, et cetera, et cetera. Right. And it's not really doing a social, positive social impact in a way that's going to change. Right. So even if it's a money maker, I'm not going to say yes because it doesn't align to my value thesis for investment.
Gotcha.
So, yeah.
No, no, that makes a lot of sense. You know, I talk a lot about this in marketing these days and that. There's this sort of growing trend, which I think is very positive of, you know, the end consumer, they want to spend their money in places where or with companies and brands that they see themselves in that brand or that brand allow, you know, aligns with their values, their beliefs, so on and so forth. And I think what you're saying is a sort of same approach from an investment perspective as well, too. It's not just about the bottom line from a financial perspective. It's about driving impact and what aligns with who you are. So that's great. That's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, it's purpose driven, right?
Yes. Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
Purpose driven. And, you know, for me, I think it's really important. I've been given, and again, this might be a lot of adoptees could be, but I feel like I've been given a second chance at life, right? Mm. And because of that, I want to be really be thoughtful in how I approach my life in general. And that also means trying to align the way that I live, what I do, how I show up to be as much in alignment as possible. Obviously, we're not perfect at it. And there's no such thing as a perfect person. If there is, oh my gosh, why aren't we replicating that? But you know what I mean? It doesn't happen. And so, yeah, do I sometimes like do things that probably went against what I would normally do? I'm sure there's plenty of things in which I do, but I try to align my life and my business as aligned as possible to what value systems that I believe in and want to be true to as much as possible across the board.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Makes sense. Kimfer, if there is someone listening to this podcast right now that was an orphan, recently maybe been adopted, kind of growing up with a, you know, similar childhood, if you will, that you have, what advice would you give to that person that might be listening right now?
Ooh, advice. That's a rough one. not a rough one. The reason why I say rough, that feels really important, like big. It feels like big, right? Mm-hmm. I think the advice that I might have is don't let your identity of being an adoptee hold you back. It can set you free to define who you want to be, how you want to model your life, and how to do things. Because I've heard a lot of people say, because I didn't have this as a model, I didn't know how to do this or that. I'm like, well, I'm a pure example of things that weren't fully modeled for me, right? But I celebrated my 25th wedding anniversary last year.
Congrats.
Thank you. Like, I didn't experience that kind of stuff. Even my adopted family separated after the farm crisis, all of that stuff, right? I think just because you haven't experienced or seen it, that doesn't mean you can't imagine a life for you and have agency over how you want to create that life for you.
Okay, gotcha. What's something you wish you were better at?
Oh, so many things. I mean, from a lighthearted areas, from like, I'm looking at my guitar over there and I learned how to play when I was in my early 20s, right? And then for a long time, and then I got it as a mother's gift because I was like, I'm going to do it. And then it's still kind of sitting there to, you know, like taking better care of my health because I tend to like overexert and sometimes too much giving and not enough for myself, like filling my cup is really important that I don't do as much and like always trying to offer to fill someone else's cup. So I definitely need to be better about that when it comes to that and my health. But I'm also so curious about so many things. Like I'm just a curious person by nature. I want to dissect it all and just learn everything. It's hard to say like one specific, but yeah.
All right. I'm going to check in with you every 6 months to see how the guitar playing is going.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, that's what I need is really someone to hold me accountable. I need that.
All right. Final question I have for you here. Another fun question. What's in your music rotation these days?
Ooh, it's also interesting because my music tastes are really all over the place. But I do have to say right now, there are three things that comes to mind. One, I finally have my walk-up song figured out.
Okay. All right.
So Get Up and Get Out by Born Dirty. Oh my gosh. As soon as I heard that, I'm like, that is it. That's my pump up song, my walk up song, whatever you call it. So before I have to go speak at a big stage or anything like that, I'm like, I have that blaring like on my way there or in the morning when I get up. And so I'm just like pumped up. I'm also in love with, I have to say, Billie Eilish's What Was I Made For? And I think that just speaks me really deeply. I think maybe it makes sense for people as they listen to the podcast as to maybe why, but that song just really like guts me every time. Mm-hmm. And the other is I just went back to South Korea last summer for the second time in my life with my sister for our 50th birthday. And we ended up getting matching tattoos. I know it sounds a little silly, but it was really important to us. Like, think about our heritage. But they were playing tons of Korean rap. And I was like, what is this? So I just Shazam all the music. And then I can't really tell you who all the artists are, but I've been trying to get like rotation of it to see who I want to like extract, right? Uh-huh. And so, yeah, I guess a lot of Korean rap.
There you go. All good. Well, Kimfer, thank you for joining us. Really appreciate you taking some time out of your day to have this, what I think is important conversation on the podcast. For anyone that's listening, if they want to reach out to you, continue the conversation, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
Oh, all the ways. LinkedIn, interesting LinkedIn. Enough. If you actually put Kimfer, K-I-M-F-E-R, you'll find me because I think I'm the only Kimfer out there. The LinkedIn community. You can connect with me there in person. I'm also on Instagram at MyKimisms. That's me personally. You can also find, you know, all my business stuff like at Inclusion Equals and at F1 Breakfast Club. Those are probably the best ways to get a hold of me.
Awesome. Well, Kimfer, thank you again for joining us on the podcast. I know that everyone listening will enjoy the episode and take something away. And for those of you listening, thank you again for tuning in to another episode of Minority Report Podcast. You can find all episodes of Minority Report Podcast wherever you listen to your podcast on the various platforms out there. Thank you again, Kimfer. Take care.
Thank you.